the lesson is that, you know, if something sounds, number one, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. And the second thing, more importantly, is, you know, it's okay to not know the answers. It's okay to not have the information. You know, that's fine. Not knowing is never a problem. The problem is not seeking the knowledge. So seek the knowledge, seek help, and then go for it because you've done the right thing.
This is Dental Leaders, the podcast where you get to go one-on-one with emerging leaders in dentistry. Your hosts, Payman Langrudi and Prav Solanki.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Hesham Ali onto the podcast. Hesham is a specialist orthodontist who works in Manchester, a consultant at the Royal Bolton Hospital in Ortho, obviously, and has a course teaching GDPs, orthodontia. Is that right? Did I say that right?
Yeah, orthodontia, which essentially just means orthodontics.
Yeah.
But I couldn't call a course orthodontics.
Yeah. Reminds me of Dentistry magazine. Such a brilliant name, isn't it?
Well, it is. It does exactly what it says on the tin, doesn't it? So yeah. Maybe. I mean, there are other courses with really sort of obvious names, and you know, maybe I should have gone with that. But I tend to be someone who overcomplicates things a lot of the times, anyway. So anyway, orthodontia was the next best thing to orthodontics, or you know, orthodontics course. I suppose these days maybe it's better to pick something that's dead obvious that someone might Google and is really a Googleable term or an SEO-friendly term, I suppose. But no, orthodontia is what we went for, and it's kind of reflects where I am, which is everything orthodontics.
So Hesham, listen, I'm interested in one particular question, right? And what used to happen is I used to start with, where were you born? And then I'd be chasing that question and not, you know, like, so I'm just going to ask it straight away so that, you know, we can get it out of the way, and then we can do whatever we want after that.
So, of course.
Do you mind?
I don't mind asking that question. I was born in Pakistan.
That wasn't the question. I'm going to ask the question that I'm going to ask. So the key question is, at what point did you say you decided to be a specialist? Was it from when, you know, before you got into university, or at what point was it that made, what was the thing that made you switch into, I'm going to be a specialist, not a generalist?
I'm going to give you the honest answer, yeah, which is that there was never one single time point where I decided to be a specialist. And truthfully, I flip-flopped more times than I can count. And when I was an undergraduate, I said, I want to be an orthodontist because I thought they were cool. And I don't know, I think I'd seen one as a child and they had a nice practice and they had a good way of life, good quality of life as well. And when I was in practice in Manchester, which is where I've spent my entire career, I enjoyed the lifestyle as an associate, which is, you know, you're young. I was 22 when I finished university. You enjoy that lifestyle. And I thought, you know what? Who needs to be a specialist? This is great. I'm working hard and I'm playing hard as well. So what's the point? But this is back in 2010, 2011. I qualified in 2009. And it got to a point where I was doing these UDAs and I was getting really fed up. And the lifestyle wasn't enough for me to say, actually, this is the lifestyle which is going to justify me on this treadmill. And I have to be honest, you know, I trained as a dentist in Ireland, in University College Cork in the south of Ireland.
Beautiful.
And the standard of training, I have to say, I'm lucky to have received that standard of training. It's very, very high. And so when I came here, I began to practice within the NHS, and I felt that really my skills weren't really being utilized. And I really felt myself being actively de-skilled. All those techniques, all those special things that I'd learned as an undergraduate were just being lost. You know, I never did face bows for crowns. I really wasn't using retraction cord that much. I wasn't really doing anything like what I was trained. And that was really depressing for me from a professional standpoint. So I had to think to myself, well, what is my way out of this? How can I deliver high quality care? How can I do what I want to do, which is just perform and do whatever I can to the best of my ability? Because I wasn't. And at that time, in 2010, 2011, the main route that I could see was specialist practice. And from the various specialties, orthodontics was the one which sort of appealed to me for a variety of reasons, which maybe we'll speak about. So really, ultimately, it was that I didn't really see how to move away from that UDA treadmill, other than to go down that specialist training pathway. And it was a very clear pathway. You know, you leave primary care, you do a hospital job or two, and then you're into specialist training as long as you are competitive enough in the interviews. And then you are a specialist and you have a different way of working. So that's kind of the story of how I ended up being a specialist, I suppose.
Yeah, but why? I mean, a lot of people come across that problem, right? I had that problem as well, but I didn't think I'm going to become an orthodontist. I thought I'm going to become a private dentist, you know, because I straight after VT, I thought I'm never going to do NHS ever again. I went, did whatever it took to get a private job. Why did you think specialist? Why didn't you think you could become a private dentist?
I didn't see the roots that are now existent. You know, remember social media wasn't really a massive thing. We had Facebook, but you know, that was kind of it. It wasn't as big as it is now. I didn't see a clear pathway as to how I can get into one of these amazing, you know, in air quotes, commas, practices. How can I actually get into that sort of a role where I can deliver that high quality dentistry? I just didn't know how I could do it. I didn't have the connections. I wasn't born and raised in Manchester or in the UK. I didn't have friends really here that went back generations or contacts in that way. I just felt a little bit trapped within.
You wanted guarantees. You wanted guarantees, right? That's what you wanted.
No, I don't even think, Payman, that it was a case of guarantees. It was a case of when I looked online at what jobs were available. Yeah. At that time, there was no sort of advertising for private jobs. There was none of this sort of going on that I can remember in my area or in most of Greater Manchester to say, we're a practice that focus on high quality private care. If you're an ambitious associate or an ambitious young dentist who wants to learn or who has a good skill set, come and work for us, come and speak to us. And now, if you go online, you will see practices who are advertising in exactly that way to say, if you've done such and such course, come and speak to us. If you are a high level aligner provider, come and work for us. You know, people are looking for skilled practitioners to come and work in their premises. Yeah. At that time, it just really wasn't the case. And it might have been that actually, maybe perhaps in London or down south, things were evolving faster back then. But I guess maybe in my little bubble in Manchester, I just didn't see it. And I'm sure there were some nice practices in Manchester at that time, as there are now. Maybe I was a little bit naive. I didn't know how to make those right connections. And
so how many years before dental school did you get to UK?
Sorry, I didn't.
From Pakistan to Cork?
No. So I grew up in Pakistan when I was until the age of about 4.
Yeah.
After that, we lived in Ireland.
Okay.
For a few years. And when I was about 8, this is, I think, 1995, we went to live in Saudi Arabia. So I was in Riyadh for 3.5 years.
Okay.
Then back to Ireland. And I stayed there from the age of 11 until I qualified as a dentist, which was 22. So that's from 98 till 2009.
Okay, I get it.
And 2009, I qualified and I came straight to Manchester for this VT year. I was in VT for that 1 year. And it's interesting, actually, because when you qualify from Ireland, you don't have to do VT when you come here.
Uh-huh.
You're exempt from it. I did it anyway because I thought it might be a good thing, nice little stepping stone. And in retrospect, probably the worst thing I ever did was to do that VT year.
Why?
Because clinically, as I said, you know, the standard practice which they give you in Ireland is very high. I didn't really need that supporter training in that sort of hand-holding way that we associated with vocational training in this country. I was a lot more independent as a practitioner at that point. Of course, you need someone to look over your cases and have someone to bounce off. I'm not saying I'm some sort of dental superhero, far from it. But what happened in that VT year was that's when my standards changed and I was just seeing the NHS stuff.
Yeah.
Actually, if you take someone with a good skill set and put them into a high-performing environment, that's where they're going to do well. That's where they'll excel. That's where they will grow.
Yeah.
But if you take someone who's high-performing and put them into an underperforming environment, they will lose their skills because those skills are not being asked of them. They're not being delivered or utilized.
Yeah.
And so actually, in retrospect,
it was demotivating for you.
Sorry?
It was demotivating for you.
Completely demotivating and de-skilling, you know, as I said. Yeah. So actually going into a supportive private practice, either staying in Ireland for a year or two or moving here into a supportive private practice, that would have been the best move because it would maintain your skills and it would open your eyes as to what else is possible, what is out there, what is the next step in your development, what is the cutting edge in dentistry.
Yeah, I get that, man. I mean, look, going back to what you said about jobs, and you couldn't see the private jobs being advertised. What I understand nowadays is people ask for jobs that aren't there. You know, they put out CVs in the practices they want to work at and go shadow those guys and until a job comes from those particular places. So interesting difference. I used to do it the way that you're saying, you know, like look at the job section of the magazine. Yeah.
Yeah.
But now the best way to get a very good job is to definitely come to things like BACD, BARD, those things. I guess in your world, it would be BOS or whatever it is. BOS, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where you meet the right, you know, the movers and shakers, isn't it?
You're right, Payman. I mean, the industry, the job market has entirely changed, as you know, in dentistry. But I still think that at the top end of performers, things haven't changed massively, and neither have they changed at the bottom. But you have a lot greater number of people trying to be more towards the upper end, or at least trying to emulate what's going on at the upper end, which is good. It's good to see in dentistry. And you're right, actually. And now the way to get a good job is it's kind of becoming a lot more commercial, or hesitantly say Americanized, where, you know, you need to sort of spend the time and have a drink or socialize or be in those events, you know, like you say, in the various forums that exist, the various societies which exist. And that might help you along the way. And again, that's something I am horrible at, you know.
Yeah. It doesn't come naturally.
I'm terrible at networking and socializing. In fact, when I met you, Payman, it was at one of the Dental Tables events.
Yeah.
And it was, now you are clearly someone, for example, who's great, amazing, a master of networking.
Networking? No, I'm not very good at networking. I don't like it at all.
You could have fooled me because, you know, when I met you, you had a cup of coffee in your hand and you just said, hey, you know, how are you? I'm Payman. What's your name? And we just got talking. And that's what, you know, that is what networking is, right? It's just being able to make that connection with someone, that link. And I think you're very good at it. And equally, that's probably something which I'm equally as bad at as you are good.
So listen, man, you know, you're saying networking. Okay, yes, networking, because what I said was networking, I guess, yeah. But the other thing, you know, we have people on our course, on our composite course, and a lot of them are there to put it on their CV so that they can get that private job or whatever it is, yeah. But I'll tell you what, my advice to them is, yeah, that, you know, bosses want three things from high-performing associates, yeah. Number one, photos, photography. And by inference, it's like Instagram, yeah. And following your community, for sure that. Number two, communications courses, you know, like they're more interested in the communication of the associate than his skill. Cause they feel like that they can learn the skill later on.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say three? Well, yeah. One was Instagram, one was photography. But you know what I mean? That it's weird. The weird thing is that none of that has anything to do with actual clinical, but that's what'll get you in, you know, get you seen and noticed by the bosses. So it's an interesting time.
It is an interesting time. And I mean, I wonder, why do you think that is?
Because that stuff's super important. Yeah. You know, it's the, you know, we can moan about it. But it is super important, you know?
I agree. I mean, I think, you know, on the communication side, 100% agree. And you'll be a lot more successful as a person, whether it's in life or in dentistry, if those communication skills are harnessed and refined. And of that, I have no doubt. But on the photography, Instagram-ish side, you know, yes, having nice or photography skills and being able to produce a good set of images is important from a documentary point of view, from a patient communication point of view, just to display your skill set. But equally, I think there's a lot of fudgery that goes on with photographs as well. And, you know, I'm a cynic, 100% self-proclaimed cynic. And, you know, when I do see photographs, I always wonder why we don't see complete sets of photographs, why we don't see photos of the teeth in the proper occlusion, and why we don't see photos of the teeth in guidance and things like that. And, you know, I think while it's great to be able to post this stuff on Instagram, and I understand that maybe the point of posting is attracting customers or attracting clientele. Yeah.
That's the answer. There's the patient facing and the dentist facing. And there's plenty of wonderful dentist facing stuff. Yeah. By the way, yeah. I see your Instagram game's quite strong. Buddy.
I don't know if it is.
Yeah, it is. But what being strong isn't necessary. It's being strong is turning up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're turning up, you know, you're doing consistent stuff. Consistent stuff brings in its own audience. You know, it's like, look, this podcast, dude, we didn't sit and sort of masterclass it out and say, what would be the most compelling format to attract listeners? We just do it. We do it. Yeah. And we do it every week and it finds its own audience. That way, you know, turning up so important in social. No, I think you play a good social game, dude. Have you got like a guy with a camera, you know, comes in every Thursday? How do you do it? Just let's talk about that. What's your execution on that?
All my social stuff. Number one, I mean, I think you're paying me a compliment, but the compliment which is not due. But you know, my social stuff. You know, if you have a look at my Instagram, I've posted a bit in the last couple of months, but not nearly consistently enough. I was much better earlier on this year, but I think that's the way sometimes, you know, you get distracted by things, and I was distracted by renovating my house, having a second child, and so many other things. And that's just an excuse, I suppose. You still got to turn up. You got to turn up, as you say. But no, you know, we obviously have different kinds of posts, and obviously I've got the patient images. And then I've got a couple of,
What's your process?
I don't have a process.
Well, you know, you've got a process. You've got a process. You're posting.
Just for my process. I think of what post am I, okay, I have a patient images. So I find a case that I finished and I just edit the images as I need to, crop them, whatever, and then I post them. The other videos, which are of me with
talking to people and stuff.
Yeah. With me with this dentist called Dr. Arnold, really nice guy. He's up in Lancashire and he's got his own little podcast going, top guy. He invited me onto his podcast. And so they came to the practice and they recorded it. And actually, some of my posts from me speaking to Arnold are that they're his, that's his footage, which I just edited and put onto my own, which I thought was great usage, you know. And people like this kind of conversation. It's much easier for me to have a conversation with someone than with a camera.
Yeah, me too.
I find that much easier. Yeah, and then too. The last kind of post is basically my stuff from my courses, some stuff that my delegates have sent, something educational that I've recorded, and I'll put that up. So I try to maintain those three types of content over my page. And you're right, it is about consistency. I think, you know, I will try to get into doing more videos, speaking to the camera type of videos. I don't know if anybody really wants to hear my voice that much or wants to see my face even less. But I have an ambition to start doing more orthodontic posts, like information posts to say, this is a bonded retainer, not for patients, but for dentists to say, these are the considerations you need to have a bonded retainer. How do you do a best bonded retainer? What are my tips and tricks? So I have an ambition to do that kind of stuff more regularly.
But do you have any team working? Do you have any team working on it at all, other than yourself?
None whatsoever.
Well, that's your error. You know, that's your error.
You're probably right.
I'm not saying go hire right now a social media ninja. I am saying that actually. If you're man enough, right? But let's say you're not man enough, right? You know, Upwork or People Per Hour put an ad out saying, "I need someone to edit videos. I need someone to make posts. I need someone to." You know, you can get someone doing that for you for almost nothing. Like, it's very little amount of money people want to do that sort of work. You know, your time, your orthodontist per hour time shouldn't be wasted on this now. Yeah, not as much.
100%. But at the same time, you know,
You need to learn it so that you've got the right words and vocabulary. That's why I take care of the posts for this podcast specifically to feel the pain of a social media person. Yeah. But we've got four full-time social, you know, the people doing all the stuff. But, you know, dude, my point when I say you're good at it is I don't know many other consultant specialists posting regularly on Instagram very well. So out of, in that category, you're like number one.
You know, that's a really strong point. It's a really strong point. And I think, you know, historically, there's been a divide between the consultant group or the academics versus, you know, people in primary care.
Yeah.
There has been a big divide. But now, actually, and I think it happened over lockdown a little bit more, I think that divide is becoming a lot narrower and we're beginning to converge. We don't have that chasm, that canyon between us as much anymore. And I do, there's a couple of colleagues now, orthodontists, very well-known academics as well, who are posting very regularly now. In fact, far more regularly than I am. So I think they have also recognized, you know, the power of this, both in terms of reaching the profession and also reaching patients. So I think it's great. I think we need to have that variety across social media. And I follow those pages. I follow those academics to say, you know, this is really good work. These are great posts. I'm learning from them as well. So I like having that variation of maybe some posts and some posters who just have cool cases or cool mechanics orthodontically. And then you've got sort of the Kevin O'Briens and Parag Flemings of this world, the academics who are posting more orthodontic, geeky, you know, scientific research and evidence. And I want to read that stuff as well. So actually having that variation is amazing. And I'm probably somewhere in the middle. I want to show some nice cases. I want to reach the dentist. I still want to be evidence-based. And I'm trying to like capture all of that within my sphere of Instagram and Facebook or whatever. So I'm in that happy zone somewhere. But you're right. I got to show up. Maybe I should get someone to do it for me. But I also think, you know, like, it's not that hard, you know, editing photos and then cropping them isn't hard. And, you know, that takes me 5 minutes to do. What takes me ages and what I still haven't really mastered is speaking to a camera.
Yeah, but you don't have to, dude. Like, you know, I can't speak to a camera, so I just don't.
That's a really strong point.
Yeah. So look, the thing is, you know, do you know, I don't know if you know Matty Parsons. He's a general dentist, does a lot of composite bonding up in Liverpool.
And right.
His Instagram's fantastically strong because he did a couple of competitions or something. He's a great, great guy. You know, could talk to camera if he wanted to, maybe. Yeah, probably. But all he has is before and after, before, after, before, after, before, after, before, after. That's all he has on his Instagram. 90,000 followers. Yeah. Like what I'm saying is you just, whatever is comfortable is the thing you should do. And that you know enough stuff, right, to have it without having to talk to the camera. Although it'd be good if you could. I can't. I much prefer this format.
This is a nice format. And I mean, I enjoyed the conversational style of it. I think with Maddie, I'm not familiar with this. I think I've heard the name for sure. But you know, with someone who has serial before and after photos and it's just a chronic poster of before and after photo, that's amazing. And obviously his work is, I'm assuming, is primarily clinical. And so the purpose of his social media is just to attract new clientele, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Whereas mine is, and maybe just for the academics, it's a little bit more nuanced or a bit more niche in that my posts also need to cover some of the educational stuff. And what that means is, I mean, I'm so aware that, myself included, I prefer to listen or watch something than to have to read the information. You know, you might be in the car, you'd stick on a podcast.
Yeah.
Or put on a book or something. So I guess the consumers of this information or of the content or my content probably want some videos. And that's where I'm a little bit stuck. You know, maybe I can just try some random posts and see if that works. But I really want to make the videos. I just feel like that's what I need to do. That's my engagement is with videos. You know, I'm so passionate about teaching. I love it. More than orthodontics, I love teaching.
Really?
And I think that when you have a passionate teacher, that's when you learn best. And I really, really want that to come across in my social media and all my contacts and my emails. I want people to know that this is his actual passion, is actually the teaching. And I don't think I get that from a static post. I think I get that from voice, from video, from facial expression.
Yeah. You know, from an online course, that would be the ultimate, right? You just buy the online course. And sell it all over the world, by the way, dude, yeah? No, why not, though?
You're right.
Yep.
You're right. What I need to do now is hire a film crew and get them to do it for me.
Don't worry, I'll do it for you and we'll do like a revenue share model.
Why not? Let's talk about it. Let's talk about it.
Wrong meeting. No, it was just after the pod. No, dude, that is a good thing to do for someone who adores teaching so much. But the thing about teaching what you adore about it, yeah, is the interesting point, I find. Because, you know, like, let's for the sake of the argument say you want to feed the hungry, yeah? Or you could be the guy driving the truck to the village and literally feeding the hungry, you know? Because that the buzz of the person grabbing the food, you know, that might be the thing that drives you, yeah? But if actually you want to feed the most people, go be an orthodontist and pay 50 of those guys to hand out the food, yeah? And with teaching, it's a similar story, yeah? Because if you want the maximum number of dentists to learn from you, an online course would be the best way, you know, thousands could learn from you that way. But it's the fun of teaching is actually watching the person when they suddenly realize light bulb moments in students.
Yeah.
And that's the actual fun of it. It's not, you know, so the fun doesn't align to the impact sort of thing.
Yeah, that's really true. That is very true. It's that, you know, when you see them becoming cognizant of something, you see the penny drop.
Yeah.
You're right. That is the fun of it. Actually, you know, I think the thing with teaching is that's a very social activity when you talk about adult education. You know, it's not like we're talking about teaching kids in a room, which is sort of didactic. Adult education and postgraduate education is all about the interaction.
Yeah.
It's a very social activity. And there's a lot of fun in that. And I think one of the nicer things about it is, apart from, you know, watching the penny drop in front of you, it's how it's building those relationships.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, you make new friends out of it. And a lot of the people come to my course, so I end up sort of mentoring them. I get to know them over a much longer period. So you're right that, you know, the value that I see from it or the fun of it, it doesn't really align with, you know, the financial impact or the delivery of teaching on a wider scale.
Yeah. In fact, I for me, the fun of it is the brilliance of the event. Yeah. And the brilliance of the event in many ways is dictated by how much money you spend on making it a brilliant event. Yeah. And so
100%.
The better the event is, the less money you're making. But, you know, it's that balance where you just, because if it's not a brilliant event, why even be there that weekend? You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Yourself.
100%. I mean, Fam, you're right, because it got, you know, I was thinking about the last event. I'm like, well, I want to do a delicate. Last time I didn't do a delicate meal, like two courses ago.
Yeah.
And this other, look, I need to really do a delicate meal this time. It's got to be nice. And, you know, by the end of the 2 days, we couldn't physically eat anymore. So the main thing that I'd done in true sort of Asian capacity was make sure everyone was well fed at all times. And we were rolling down the stairs at the end of the event.
Did you get
way too much food?
Did you get the wedding caterers in?
I might as well have used the banquet. It really was. From start to finish, there was just no space at all. You know, so, you know, that made the event for me. You know, I want people to go back and have like a smile on their face and say, remember that time, that course we went on, we ate so much. Oh, yeah. And there was something about aligners as well.
But, okay, dude, you know, you say you want people to feel that about you, yeah? Tell me this, dude. How does it align, right? The growing up in three different countries, changing school that many times, having to make new friends. And were you on one of those US military bases in Saudi? Is your dad a doctor?
No. My dad was an anesthetist. Uh-huh. So he was a doctor out there. And we were in Riyadh at that time, we used to live in sort of hospital compounds. So, and the hospital had housing associations of compounds all over the city.
Yeah.
And you were in one of those. And there were other people that were employed by the hospital in the same compound.
In an international school full of expat types.
That's right. So there was two main international schools. One was the American and one was the British school. And we went to the British school, which was amazing, by the way. You know,
a good school.
I mean, the school was fantastic and the facilities were, I mean, we think about the Saudis these days. We think about they're buying Newcastle, you know, AJ and Tyson are going over to fight in Jeddah or Riyadh, you know, but even at that time, you know, life in Saudi was amazing. Amazing. As kids growing up, we went to this amazing school with really high quality education. The teachers were fantastic. the school was so well decked out. It had such good facilities. You know, I can't even begin to tell you, you know. So it was a great time growing up in the Middle East at that time. You know, in your housing compound, you had swimming pool, you had tennis court or basketball court. You had friends your age. It was totally safe. You know, we're talking about 15 or 20 houses within four walls, locked gates, completely safe. You knew absolutely everybody. And as soon as you got home, there was a race to the swimming pool. And then in the evening, there was a race to the courts. And so as sort of an 8 to 11-year-old, you know, you couldn't ask for more than that. All you wanted to do was get home and start swimming or playing football or doing something with your friends.
What kind of a kid were you? Top of your class?
There or thereabouts most of the time.
Was it that kind of house where the parents just incentivize study more than everything else? Or was it more rounded than that?
I think they de-incentivize underperformance is probably the way to get it. and you have to read between the lines on that one. it's interesting actually because in any walk of life, there's two ways to get the job done, right? Either you incentivize
performance
or the other way around.
Yeah.
And we weren't really kids who were incentivized for performing well. That was just an expectation. That was an expectation to say, well, these are the grades you need to get. And if you get them, and it wasn't even a thumbs up. It was like you've hit the mark now.
Yeah.
Stay there.
Yeah.
But God forbid the thumb started pointing down. And it did. It did on occasion. So, you know, you have to be careful. But yeah, our household was like that. You know, you had to sort of achieve the grades. And I suppose it's that classic, South Asian or Asian type of pressure that we all have spoken about, probably within our friends or elsewhere, to say, oh yeah, my parents expected me to get 10 A's or whatever it was. And we were no different from that point of view.
Yeah. So then the thing I said about changing schools, meeting new people, yeah?
Yeah.
It probably means that you're quite good at that, you know, like meeting new people. I mean, obviously, you can go in one of two directions.
Right.
But, you know, what are your reflections on that? Like how it transfers to you today?
I think as a child, it's very unsettling because you do have to build those relationships every couple of years.
Yeah.
You know, there was times when I moved school sort of every 9 months or something for a couple of years. So that's very difficult to do. So you don't really build those long-term bonds. Having said that, some of the people that I've known the longest time in my life are from that 3-year stint in Saudi from 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So you make some really good connections and you can build them over years. I suppose the nice part of it is that, you know, number one, having moved around so much, but also having moved around internationally, you get exposed to a lot of different types of people and different cultures, different race, ethnicity, different religions, particularly in Saudi. You know, in an expat school, you have the Muslims, you have the white British expats, you have people from Africa, you have people from everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's really nice to have that because you don't really get that everywhere. And now in this country, we're very, it's like a cosmopolitan. We have different exposures depending on where you are in the country. But it was great to have it at that time.
Mm.
And I think that makes you a much more rounded person.
For sure.
You do also then get a sense of what it's like to have to build those relationships again and again. So there is that benefit when you grow up that maybe you can do that. But I do feel like it's a little bit of faking it. And that you sort of almost have to be confident and you have to feel or tell yourself that you feel okay with constantly meeting new people, constantly making new friends. And as an adult, you're still doing that a little bit. You're still saying, look, it's okay to go and meet a stranger at a conference and say, hey, what's up? Yeah. Hey, man. You know, so it does give you that something to fall back on. Say, I've done this as a child. I can do this as an adult almost.
Yeah.
But I still feel internally like I'm still moving to a new school every time I go to a conference and I meet somebody new.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm going to have to introduce myself and develop that relationship with them. And the funny thing is, you know, Bayman, like, you know, with conferences, Most people know a lot of people at various conferences.
Mm.
Orthodontists don't know that many people at conferences because our specialty has historically been quite isolated. And whether that's self-imposed or not, I don't know. But it is relatively isolated, and we don't share that many conferences with the general dental forum. And so when I come to dental tubules or I go to somewhere else, there won't be, I might find one or two other orthodontists at the most. But everybody else is a prosthodontist or an oral surgeon or a general dentist or a marketing guy or something like that. I don't really know anybody. So when I do go to these conferences, I'm at another new school.
Oh,
and I have to find some more new friends.
No, I know the feeling, buddy. I know the feeling because I'm painfully shy. You know, I know what you said, but I'm painfully shy. I hate it. I'm really, really shy. There are people in Leighton, yeah, that I haven't introduced myself to, employees of mine, yeah, because no one's sort of introduced me to them. I'm really, really shy person as well, but it's just one of those things, man.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you just got to be careful with your employees that it doesn't get to a point where, you know, when you met someone or you know them and then you've had interaction with them, you've now known them for 3 or 4 years, but actually you still don't know their name. Yeah, you don't want to get to that point.
That's happened to me as well. Because we're on different sites as well. Yeah. There's, you know, like I might see our warehouse maybe once every 2 years. I just don't go there. It's like, it's not where I go. Yeah. So listen, man.
So how do you get around that? How do you get around that sort of feeling of
apprehension
or shyness?
I don't like it, dude. I'm really bad at it. I mean, now in a dental environment, it's, you know, I'm getting a bit senior, right? But I still don't like it. And I find it really weird. Yeah. People come to me and say, hey, I listened to your podcast. I've listened to 100 episodes. Yeah. And I love, it's a nice feeling, of course, when someone says that, right? But I feel really like really weak in that situation because I feel like they know me really well. I don't know them. I'm pretty shy again. You know, it's weird, man. This is a nice little bit of therapy for both of us, huh? The new school therapy. Tell me this, bud. Let's get to a little bit of ortho. I'm interested in this, question of your average GDP is a funny thing to say, right? A relatively junior GDP, yeah. Coming to your course for 2 days, is it a 2 day course?
It is, yes.
Okay, so that guy or someone who's done, I don't know, 100 Invisalign cases comes to your course. Do you start from the beginning and people get from it what they get from it? Or how do you manage that, the difference between those two? Or do you get a typical avatar type that comes and they're all similar bit of their career?
We get a full range. Uh-huh. And one of the courses that I did, I had a newbie. I mean, I think sort of 1 year qualified.
Yeah.
And I had a consultant orthodontist in the same room.
Wow.
So you can imagine the spectrum that was there.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is that the majority of people who do aligners, I mean, the vast majority, or above 90%, I would say, haven't spent the time to investigate and understand what it is they're actually doing. And that encompasses the materials, you know, the attachments, the biology of tooth movement, the mechanics of tooth movement, and we haven't even started talking about the aligners and how they move the teeth and how to stage treatment and IPR and all those other things just yet. We're just talking about the basic sciences, a bit like when you go to dental school and you have to learn the anatomy, you have to learn some physiology, you have to learn the histology, you have to understand what enamel prisms are and what the hybrid layer is if you're going to do complex. You have to understand all these things.
Yeah.
And until you do, well, you're probably going to do pretty rubbish dentistry. Now, it's not knowledge that you might need when you're doing that filling. But if you don't have that knowledge, you probably won't know why you're doing a good filling or why your fillings keep failing, for example. And in the same, it's the same with aligners. If you've done 100 cases, hopefully you're very good at managing your workflow. You might have done a bit of trial and error and figured out what works and what doesn't work. But your approach to case management or clinical care is unlikely to be scientific because you haven't taken a scientific approach to your learning. You haven't understood what the principles are and what the steps are in approaching your case in a systematic and scientific manner. So that was the problem. And I remember when I was a GDP for 2 years before I left and went into hospital, into specialty training. I did two aligner cases when I was a GDP. Back then, it was a company called ClearStep who went bankrupt. You remember, I'm sure everybody remembers. Yeah. And I spoke to Arnold about this, actually. And, you know, I did these two cases and they were awful. Horrible. And, you know, I remember the training. It was, here, take a silicone impression and we'll send you back a plan. Here's a great consent form you can use. But that's not treatment planning, is it? Yeah. That's taking an impression and signing a form. That's what that is. And so the idea of the course came from this concept that actually I was GDP. I wasn't appropriately trained to do something. And actually something went wrong in those cases. So when I saw that happen, I thought, at that time, this is not for me. I can't do more aligning so I know what I'm doing. And that was one of the triggers that led me down the specialist pathway. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in the last couple of years, when I decided to do this course, I tried to capture that feeling of what was it that I didn't know. And I realized that what I didn't know was everything in orthodontics. Everything got to do with material science. Everything got to do with biology and mechanics of tooth movement. So the course then basically was designed to answer all those questions and give people the building blocks they need to actually deliver proper treatment, not just focus on a brand of aligner treatment. So actually, you know, you can have a consultant in the same room as a year one GDP or year two GDP, and a lot of the material is relevant to everybody because, you know, they haven't covered it before. And yes, there will be some stuff which isn't relevant to the consultant or to somebody a bit more experienced, but unless you are that consultant, most people aren't. They'll just be more experienced GDPs or even some specialists. Then that knowledge will apply to you equally as much as it will to that junior colleague. But the one thing I'd say is kudos to the junior colleague for coming along on year one and two rather than waiting for 100 cases.
Yeah, I agree with that. But the first time I did an Invisalign case, I could not believe I was doing an Invisalign case after the 2 days. They basically, well, it was a one day course where they were basically showing you how to use the software. There was nothing. I couldn't believe I was doing ortho. I mean, it was a long time ago. Before you qualified even. But nowadays, right, the number of cases that are going through, the importance of it, dude, like if you had to sort of put your finger on the very important critical difference between someone who understands materials, biology, tooth movement, what's the critical point? I mean, you know, the way Aligner talking about it is that, you know, that their supercomputer AI has analyzed 5 million cases and just knows where to put everything. So there it is.
You're right, Feynman. But then why do we do refinements?
Yeah, true.
Why do we do refinements if they've got, you know, a million cases and they've got the scans at the beginning, they've got the scans at the end.
Yeah.
So surely, you know, their supercomputer can work out what has gone wrong, what has gone well, what attachments were there, and what do we need to modify here? Surely. Now, what's really interesting is that I'm sure you've heard the line, you know, that, you know, the lie is halfway down the street before the truth is out of bed. And it's true in every walk of life, and dentistry is no different. And so with aligners, you know, if we say that we're going to get a certain amount of tooth movement or they can do this or they can do that, it's not really true. And the evidence is now coming out to say, well, the predictability of treatment is actually quite poor. And we can now begin to grade how effective or how predictable individual tooth movements are. So is overbite reduction going to be 100% of what we're seeing on the treatment simulation? It's not. It's going to be, you know, roughly half of what we're seeing, or so on and so forth. What about rotations? What about angulation, et cetera, et cetera? So we know that that's not true because the science is actually now there. The thing that aligner companies had was they had the benefit of a lack of science, so they could say whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. But now the science is there. So you can't just say whatever you want because the science is obviously existent. Anyone can go and research it. And as clinicians, you know, we shouldn't be hesitant to apply the science, we shouldn't say, well, Align are saying this, or ClearCredit are saying that, and Spark are saying this, so it must be true. And the last thing I'd say is that, you know, AI doesn't have an understanding of the biological limitations or the biological parameters around treatment. It doesn't have an understanding of patient compliance. It doesn't have an understanding of the various failures that can happen during treatment. It doesn't have an understanding of any of this. And all of these are massive factors when you consider what kind of treatment we want to deliver and how we want to plan to deliver that movement.
So give me that example. Give me that example. Yeah, we're knowing just an example, one of many, right? We're knowing about the materials, about the bone. What goes wrong? What do dentists commonly do wrong that they shouldn't with aligners? And if they knew what they know with your bit, they wouldn't do. Go on, just an example.
Well, you have to come to my course to find out. No, I'm only joking. I'll tell you what it is. Yeah. The number one thing I see is overexpansion of the upper and lower arches, which we know is unsafe because you're violating the biological and periodontal parameters. Yeah. That's the number one thing.
Yeah.
And the second thing I see is really poor finish or really poor occlusion. And the caveat is, well, the patient was okay with it. Mm-hmm. And I feel that that is a get out of jail card that a lot of us are using. And it's not really justified to say, well, the patient didn't say anything, the patient didn't complain. Because you're actually the healthcare provider. You should be providing the optimal level of care. And to say, well, the patient didn't really care, well, the patient wasn't too bothered, so I left it high in the occlusion or whatever, that's not really a satisfactory outcome for me. I think that's a cop-out. I think it's really a poor standard of care to be delivering that kind of service. And I think that if that's what you want to deliver, then you shouldn't do the treatment. Let someone do the treatment who can actually deliver to the right standard and who holds themselves to a higher authority than patient not complaining.
Agreed. I mean, patient not complaining is you know, down here, and patient delighted and sending you another patient is a long way away from. There's a big space between those two.
Sometimes it's length of payment, isn't it? I mean, you can straighten someone's teeth, but if you leave them with a lip trap that they're not complaining about, they may not even realize it. They might just accept that. You know, or sometimes, you know, dentists or people will say, "Well, I told them they're going to have a lip trap." It doesn't mean it's okay in my book.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's okay. It's still a negative outcome.
So, dude, you know, it's kind of similar to endo, isn't it? Right. So, you know, some general dentists can do endo and want to do endo, and then there is a point where they feel like referring. Yeah. But with ortho, you've got the kind of dentist who doesn't do any ortho, and he's going to have to refer, you know, earlier. But then you've got the kind of a whole spectrum of dentists who do ortho. What do you tell them? What do you tell them is the time that they should be referring to a specialist? Or is it different for each person? I mean,
yeah, it's different for each person and their experience level. Some people have mentors that help them along. So I mentor a lot of dentists, for example. So maybe they're tackling an increased complexity of case as their skill level increases.
Yeah,
I think the difference, for example, is that with endodontics, you know, the outcome, even with a specialist, is not necessarily guaranteed. You know, even if you go and see one of those, you know, if we see Sanjeev down in Manchester, he'll still tell you, I'm sure there's a risk of failure here because it will eventually fail. The thing with orthodontic treatment, though, is that generally speaking, it's a fairly traditionally a predictable treatment. You kind of know what tooth movements are going to occur, what kind of tooth movements need to occur, what's the final overjet going to be like, what's the final overbite going to be like. If there's any spaces left, you kind of know where they're going to be and how big they're going to be as well. And if you can't, you know, really plan in that way, and if you're saying, well, let's give you some aligners and let's see what it looks like. Let's see what it looks like. And then we'll see if we need some more aligners. And then we'll see if maybe we need some composite afterwards. That's not really a roadmap to success, really. That's a hidden hope. You know, when you go to London from Manchester, you have your sat-nav on, and sat-nav tells you the route they need to go on. And yeah, you might encounter a problem, an accident, and you might have to take a little detour to get to the same endpoint, but you still have an overall route. And a lot of the times with aligners, the mentality seems to be, well, we'll see how much we get done, and then the rest of it, we'll see. You might need some veneers, you know, we might need some full coverage crowns, you might need some composite. And for me, that's not really a satisfactory way of planning. I think that you can plan with a much higher degree of predictability, because also on a tooth movement is generally quite predictable in terms of what movements are going to occur. So why can't we do that? Why can't all dentists plan in that way? and say, actually, we know what the final solution is going to be like because we planned it. We didn't just align the teeth and hope for the best. We planned it. We told the patient in advance exactly what it's going to be like, or almost what it's going to be like. And we planned the restorative phase as well. And that to me is high quality treatment. That to me is informed consent. That for me ticks all the boxes of communication and everything else. So I guess that's my
inflection point.
Yes. Well said.
That's lovely, man. So when they come on this 2-day course, what do you teach them? How long does it take you to teach them the basic science bit? I mean, it doesn't seem long enough, does it, dude? That.
Oh, well,
is there a continuum? By the way, we do ours. Is our composite course is a 2-day course, but there should be a continuum we haven't got round to, you know?
Yes.
Is there more than two days?
My course is 2 days. And what I always say to anybody, whether they're mentoring or whether they're coming onto course, is to say, look, I can't, Rome was built in a day. And I can't teach you orthodontics in 2 days. What I can do is give you the essential building blocks you need. The essential. And I've got this, picture of a roadmap, much like our London to Manchester or vice versa analogy. And there's a car and it's going from point A and it's got a marker on point B where it's going. And actually what I say is, what I start saying now is that point B shouldn't really be there. It should just be a road. And the point B isn't it? It's an infinity somewhere.
Yeah.
Because even for me, as the person providing the teaching, I'm still on that road. I'm just further along the road.
Yeah.
So the continuum is there. I think, when you say how long does it take to teach the basics? I'd say the 2 days. The 2 days is what it takes to teach the basics. Because, each topic or each lecture or each part of the conversation that we have is about something different. And all of those things are essential. They are absolutely essential to do any treatment with the aligners. So I would say the 2 days is where you need to learn the basics. And actually, more recently, I've had a thought to do a second course, which is going to be aiming to cater for those people who have grabbed the basics, who understand the right way to do the treatment, who understand the biological and orthodontic limits and parameters that you should be working to, understand the importance of not, insulting the periodontium, and then going through a more advanced type of course where actually we're showing you more specifically how to use the 3D controls, how to do things in greater detail to really refine your cases, minimize the number of treatment phases that you need, making them more comfortable with the software. Because truthfully, most of the planning they need for orthodontics is done in your mind. Most of it is mind. It's mind work. The rest of it is just a bit of clicking on the computer. Once you've mastered the mind work, starting the second course will be great for people who want to really master the software as well.
So do you do things like massive overcorrections, change the shape of the attachments, all of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that part is key. Because we know, in the same way with braces, braces underdeliver, fixed braces. They underdeliver on what we want them to do. So it's up to the clinician to understand where that underperformance is going to be and to manage that appropriately. And aligners are no different. They underperform massively, far more than fixed braces. So again, it's just a matter of understanding how, when, and why the underperformance is going to occur, and then building the mechanisms to try and account for that during your treatment. So, modification of attachments and adjustment of the tooth positions, all of these things account for the underperformance within the appliance system itself. And it's no difference whether you use Invisalign or Clear Correct or Spark. It doesn't matter. Or Sure Smile, forget. We'll say all the big boys, no one feels left out. They all underperform in a similar way. And so if you understood the science behind why you're doing what you're doing, well, what I say to everyone is every case becomes the same case because all you're doing is applying your knowledge to that particular case. You're doing things in a systematic way to account for underperformance. And so my aim really is to give dentists that knowledge.
Tell me this, dude. If you're saying you can be so sure about the outcome at the outset, that's what you're saying, yeah?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Oh, you're not?
No, what I'm saying is that you know that there's going to be underperformance.
Yeah.
Because the science is now telling us where the underperformance actually is. There's research out there to tell us where it is. So you can try and build in mechanisms to correct that.
Yeah.
Because there's biological variation between you and I, for example, Payman.
Yeah.
That overcorrection or that mechanism to address underperformance may not be expressed in the same way between you and I. So I'm still going to need to do some refinements. I'm still going to have to do some corrections later on, but I should know what the outcome is going to be. I should know what my overreject and overbite are going to be at the end of treatment.
So do you do that service where you do the treatment planning for the dentist?
No, I don't believe in that whatsoever.
Wow.
I think that's a quick ticket to litigation. I'll tell you why. It's because number one, you know, as a dentist who's providing treatment, you need to be in control of your treatment. And if you've got someone else to do your plan for you and you don't understand why they've put in those attachments or why you might need to use elastics at a particular point, then when it comes to using those elastics and when it comes to monitoring the treatment progress, how will you do that if you don't know why you did it in the first place and what to look for? And so I don't think it's a good service to, as an educator, as a consultant, as someone who teaches postgrads and everybody else, I don't think it's the right service to offer our profession to say, here's a quick plan that I did. Hopefully it works for you. If it doesn't, really sorry. Scan it again. I'll charge you another $200 to do another plan for you. I'll only take 20 minutes to do the plan. Hopefully it'll work. If not, refinement 3, come back, I'll charge another $200 or whatever my fee is. And I don't think it's teaching the dentists or teaching the users of that service to be better clinicians. I don't think it's going to necessarily achieve better outcomes. So I don't really believe in that as an approach to education or approach to care. I think clinicians still retain legal responsibility for that. So if I did a plan for you and it doesn't go well, the patient's going to come after you. I'm going to have my, you know, contracts in places to make sure that I'm fine. You're the one that clicked the approve button.
Yeah, but I'm still more confident with your plan than mine. So I'll take that risk.
Well, you might, but I suppose that's a philosophical divide. Isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel that I get it. There's a business and there's a market for that. I totally understand that. I disagree with it from an educational standpoint. Or from a clinical standpoint, from a patient care standpoint, that you don't know what you're doing with your patient. And I don't really want to be a part of that. You know, my whole ethos is on providing high quality care, high quality education that's ethically driven, that does the right thing. You know, say no to drugs. That's my thing. So I don't want to be even perceived as someone that thinks that there's a shortcut to doing good treatment, because there isn't. And I think everyone should be responsible for their own care.
That's a good point, man. Let's talk about darker times. We have a thing on this pod where we talk about errors, clinical errors.
Yes.
In the hope that we can all learn from each other's a little bit rather than hiding our errors, like, you know, that black box thinking idea.
Yeah.
What comes to mind when I say clinical errors?
You know what? I only have two that stick in my mind over my career, really. I'm sure I've made plenty of errors, though. But there are only two which stick to mind. And I guess it's because part of those are the two cases or the two examples that led me to where I am. And there are two aligner cases. I mean, nothing crazy. I mean, you know, so please, I don't want there to be a suspense around what I'm going to say. But clinical errors, you know, it was those two early aligner cases that I did. And I'll tell you about them, should you wish.
Yeah.
You know, it was one, I think the first case I did was this middle-aged lady, and she had some periodontal disease historically, and I was a happy-go-lucky associate, you know, and I said, yeah, pull the trigger, get the aligners done, bonded her up with the attachments, and I think, I don't know how many number of aligners in, you know, the upper lateral incisor was mobile.
Oh.
And I thought, oh.
God.
And, you know, I was... you know, I'm not sure you're allowed swearing on this, but
yeah, you are.
You know, I was shit scared. I thought, what have I done? I was a year one or two associate after VT. Oh. I mean, very junior, not a clue why this tooth was mobile. And, you know, thinking back, I'm thinking, was it a problem? Because teeth are actually mobile during orthodontic treatment anyway. Like, how foolish was I to, number one, to panic? I mean, teeth are meant to be mobile during orthodontic treatment, right? But I think this was a bit more mobile than I wanted it to be. Because she had a bit of perio or whatever in the past. And even now, I think, thinking back, it probably wasn't a problem, but I panicked. And I sort of froze the treatment, referred her onto a specialist orthodontist.
Expansion, like you just said. Is that what it was?
No, it wasn't expansion. I was derotating a lateral. But it might have proclined a bit, outside the bone. I don't know. I don't know, because I didn't have a cone beam.
So what cone happened? What happened? Did you say what happened with the patient?
I stopped the treatment.
Yeah, but patient Patient confidence. Did they sort of tweak that you'd made an error? What happened? Did you tell them I've made an error? What happened?
I think I'm so like blinded by my sheer panic from that time. I'm managing my own feelings. I don't even remember how the patient handled it. I think we
it
said,
can't
look,
have been
we
that bad. Good.
Yeah, I think we said, look, I did that thing, which I tell dentists not to do, of course, which is tell the patient it's okay.
Yeah.
We've got a good improvement and we can manage the rest with a bit of restorative work, but go and see a periodontist first, something along those lines. And yeah, we'd aligned the rest of the other incisors. There was an improvement, but that's not a good outcome.
No.
And anyway, I stopped doing the aligners for a little while. After a few months, I saw another case, and this one was a crowded case. And I sort of got my confidence back. And I said, okay, there's no perio here. This is a go.
Mm-hmm.
And again, took the impressions and got the aligners made. And again, lateral incisor, which are the bane of aligners, but it just would not align. It would not align no matter what I did, no matter how many elastics I used and bootstrapped and forums that I went on. I just couldn't get it to go. And in the end, the patient needed to have fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fail at that point, isn't it? Financially, it's a fail. Clinically, it's a fail. Patients losing confidence in you. It's just not a win whatsoever.
Yeah.
And, if you think about it, those failures, those cases, just
led you to become
multiple failures
within
that case.
Consultant orthodontist.
Yeah. Now I'm a consultant. At that time, I was a GDP.
Yeah.
Didn't know any better. And, there's failures in diagnosis. There's failures in understanding how teeth move. There's failures in understanding the physiology, understand that the teeth are going to become mobile. There's failures in monitoring the treatment. There's failures at every single stage of payment. So I don't think it gets any bigger than that. And you know what? Both cases, they didn't end up, with any sort of claims or anything like that. Both patients had decent outcomes at the end of it. But from my point of view, that wasn't where I wanted to be as a clinician. Certainly not as a young, enthusiastic practitioner. That's not what you want.
And the lesson we have to learn from this is know your shit before getting into stuff. Is that the lesson?
The lesson is that, if something sounds, number one, if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
And the second thing, more importantly, is, it's okay to not know the answers. It's okay to not have the information. That's fine. Not knowing is never a problem. The problem is not seeking the knowledge. So seek the knowledge, seek help, and then go for it because you've done the right thing.
So interesting, man. When I talk to whoever I'm talking to, it could be a lawyer, it could be whoever I'm talking to, a marketing guy. And if I ask a question and they say, I don't know, my respect for them goes straight up. Instead of what we think, is that, if you say you don't know, the patient's going to feel, why don't you know?
Yeah.
That's your instinct says, I can't say I don't know. But from the other side of it, I've personally, when someone says I don't know, I like that.
Yeah.
It's a bit like Andrew Darwood was saying, when I spoke to him, he said, if you're going through all the things that could go wrong during treatment and you're saying it with some authority, you're saying this could happen, that way, you're not putting the patient off. You're actually giving the patient confidence because they think, this guy's been around the block, knows what he's doing, knows what's possible, what can go wrong, It's a bit like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you're right on that. And actually, the thing is, right, how would you feel if your dentist, someone who's delivering healthcare to you,
that I don't know.
Because advertising is one thing. Marketing is one thing. But what if they said, I don't know?
If I asked him a question and he said, I don't know, I'd be totally cool.
You'd be cool.
Well, if you said, I don't know, but I'll find out, right? That's the kind of thing you want from them. I'd much rather that than think he just made it up on the spot, which I guess people are good at hiding that, right? They are good at hiding that. But like I say, I like it. I like hearing I don't know from professionals, personally. Mm.
No, I do think it's a good thing. I do. And you're right. You know, when you do tell your patients,
you know what it is, dude, it's a difference between knowing your stuff and saying, I don't know. It's very different to not knowing your stuff and saying, I don't know.
I love that. That's very well put.
Because you know your stuff, dude. So when you're saying, I don't know, you're telling the guy, you know, as someone who knows a lot, I don't know. It's a totally different story. You know?
Yeah, I suppose it's like that concept of, you know, for example, when I consent my patients, I tell them, look, one of the risks is tooth loss.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I say it. I said, that's the worst thing that can happen is tooth loss. And it's never happened in any of my cases, but it's a theoretical risk. Or I say, you know, one of the risks is root resorption. They say, what are the chances? And I say, in your specific case, I don't know, but here's what the evidence says about it generally.
What is it?
It's 100% of cases will get root resorption.
Really?
100%. And a very, very, very small minority will get severe root resorption. In other words, 50% of root loss or more.
How many?
I don't know.
Well done, man. I love that, dude. I love, well done, man.
I think it's less than 2%. It's less than 2%. But I don't want to, because people are listening to this, I don't want to say, said it, and he's a consultant. So, I'm going to say I don't know, but it's around about less than 2%.
Sure, man, sure. You know, I always find it interesting. Yeah, ortho has this wonderful position in our profession. Yeah, oh, refer the kid for ortho this, ortho that. And in a way, like, as if it's not cosmetics. Yeah, you know? Ortho is cosmetics, buddy, yeah? Ortho is cosmetics, yeah? If the cosmetic benefits of ortho weren't there, who would send their kid to have a 2% risk of root resorption?
But
what I'm saying is, I'm very happy with ortho being cosmetics, dude. Yeah. But there's a bunch of people in our profession who refer to ortho as if it's some sort of wonderful thing. And then you say, hey, how did you ask about teeth whitening? They're like, whoa. it's like a massive shock or something to them that we're talking about cosmetics outside.
For sure. I agree with you. Look, a lot of adult orthodontics in primary care is cosmetic driven. Huge, and child.
Let's not be silly.
For the children, you know, there is some psychosocial benefits. It's not to say that that's a primary factor, but you know, kids who have their teeth straightened are a lot more confident, seem to be generally a lot happier, and probably have less teasing as well. So there is some clear societal or psychosocial benefits there. That's the first thing. And then if we talk about orthodontics as a specialty, I think what most of the profession are exposed to is, referring the kids at the age of 10 or 11, you know, for an orthodontic assessment, they come back with braces, maybe some teeth out, straight teeth. All the adults have a bit of ceramic or aligners or whatever, or incognito, and, you know, they have their teeth done. It's cosmetic. But don't forget that a lot of the cases, particularly that consultants are treating, are in secondary care or even in primary practice. We see a huge amount of multidisciplinary cases. Huge. Let's not forget cleft care. Let's not forget the craniofacial centers. Let's not forget hypodontia patients. Let's not forget multidisciplinary patients otherwise. You know, all of that is orthodontics. And, you know, privately, I've seen so many referrals for just even routine secondary care NHS patients who don't want to wait in the waiting list.
Yeah.
You know, they've got hypodontia or they need orthognathic surgery. These are patients with a proper functional deficit or facial deformity. And particularly as consultants, we treat a huge number of those patients. So yeah, I think from the broad spectrum that most of the profession sees, there is a significant component of cosmetic orthodontics. And that is what's led to aligner explosion. But as a specialty, you know, we have a huge portion of our time dedicated to complex malocclusion, multidisciplinary treatment, or just complex dental alveolar stuff. I mean, the amount of central incisors that I have to align every year or every couple of years is massive, you know, and I suppose that, you know, no one should say, well, that central incisor for that kid, it shouldn't be done or it's purely cosmetic. I mean, the kid hasn't got a front tooth.
Yeah, okay, well. I get it.
And yeah, that is cosmetic.
That's
still
cosmetic,
right? But,
dude.
But that is cosmetic, but it's outside the norm of what society expects for that kid.
I get it. Look, I'm just bitter. That's all. I'm just bitter about my
bleaching.
I'm
used to it, man. I'm an orthodontist.
I mean, you know, they should have just said, you know, as part of an examination, take shade, and then everyone would be doing that, and that'd be the end of it. But Pay wouldn't have to like sit here and bitch on a podcast.
Dude, I don't think anyone is, you know, I'm holding for people who can't see me, but I'm currently twitching the world's smallest violin between my index finger and my thumb. So Pay, man. But you know what? You should be happy. You should be happy because the exposure and aligner treatment has led to even more patients having their teeth whitened.
No, what?
There's
the
no
free,
doubt about
free
it.
Whitening, yeah. The free whitening. Works.
Yeah, but they pay you for it.
No, they don't. They don't. They go for the cheapest, crappiest one they can find. Yeah.
That's true.
There is a thing they call the upgrade conversation, which is, hey, start with free whitening. And then at the end, say, hey, do you want to upgrade to, you know, Vivera and Light and that combination? Yeah.
Vivera and Light. Yeah. Why not?
Because
what you just start doing is start giving those little tiny toothpaste tubes you get in airplanes, like the tiny.
They cost money to make those. You know, people think they're just.
Yeah, but if they can just do a couple of teeth, you know. And
the number of times people have asked for those, yeah, and we, you know, that just costs extra money on top of all the other money. You have to just make those on top now, yeah. Tell me about, I quite enjoyed your dark period there. So tell me something else, you know, career-wise. I mean, okay, that was patient error, yeah? When was the darkest day in your career? Because a lot of ups and downs, dude. Yeah, I'm looking at your CV here on my other screen. Masters in Dental Public Health.
Those were dark days, let me tell you.
And you've done three different ortho, like an MSc in ortho, an M-Orth, and then a fellowship as well.
Yes.
There must have been some dark days in this little career. But.
Yeah, look, I think academically, I think the Master's at Dental Public Health was, I did that while I was an associate. And I did that, in my second year of associateship and in my first year as an SHO in MaxFax, I did that Master's. And it was good because it gave me a really good academic grounding, you know, in research methods and biostatistics, all this kind of stuff. And it also bolstered my CV because I needed to do that to get into orthodontics, which is obviously a national recruitment process. It's highly competitive, right? Mm. So I had to do that. I mean, the other stuff is kind of more routine, you know. Now they've actually taken it out, but historically you had to do a master's as part of your specialty training in orthodontics. You also then had to do the membership exam from the Royal College as an exit exam, essentially. And then the FDS is the fellowship. That's sort of your consultant examination.
And what about your advice to someone who wants to get into ortho?
I mean, I think...
How harsh is it? How hard is it?
You start working as hard as you can as early as possible.
Really?
And make sure it is something that you really want. You really want. Because I have to admit to you that, you know, I do have colleagues, you know, consultant colleagues, and sometimes, you know, we'll chat and we'll say, guys, was it worth it? Because it's a long time payment.
Mm.
It's a long time. And the opportunity cost of specialist training in orthodontics is massive.
Yeah.
It's huge. Particularly if you're a hardworking, enthusiastic, highly skilled associate.
Yeah.
Who has really good, you know, work ethic. The opportunity cost is massive. The life afterwards is really good, I have to tell you. And in terms of dark days, you know, just going back to your first question, you know, the dark days in my career don't really relate to, I mean, I talked about those two clinical cases, but the rest of it doesn't really relate to cases or clinical care. It relates more to, how should we say? I think relationship management.
Go on.
And, you know, when you are someone junior in your career, when you're answerable to trainers and supervisors and stuff like that, I think, you know, and particularly as an adult, you know, when we go to university, we're still kind of kids, aren't we?
Mm.
We've just left school. We don't mind someone telling us what to do and where to be. We almost need it because we're still kids.
Yeah.
As an adult, you know, as sort of someone in their late 20s, early 30s, it can be difficult to absorb instruction in the same way.
Are you Are you telling me you have a problem with authority?
I'm not saying that. I don't think it's a problem with authority. But what I'm saying, I have difficulty absorbing instruction is what I said. No, look, I think,
go on, spit it out. We'll cut it out. What happened? Just say it.
No, I think we'll cut it out. Just say it and we'll cut it out. I've lived everywhere. I've lived around the world, right? A little bit. Not around the world, but I lived in different places. British society has a very sort of unique structure. And this, we still have a very hierarchical society. And that's reflected within the academic institutions.
Yeah.
And there isn't much place for individualism.
Well, you say that, dude, yeah, but I mean, I don't know if you've ever come across like the French, right? The very, very, very conservative, man. I mean, you know, at least in London, you see the odd people with, you know, punk or a skinhead or something. The French are just homogenous from what I've seen, man.
You know, that's interesting. You know, I think, yeah, you're right. Maybe I'm sort of generalizing
but
too
I hear
much.
What you
yeah,
say. I hear what you say. Society. I hear what you say. I hear what you say. And the problem I see with it is almost like there's no middle. There's the best restaurants in the world are in London. Yeah. But if you randomly walk into a restaurant, you'll probably have a terrible experience. You know, like there's or the best universities we have, or the best, you know, we do have the best of a lot of things, best healthcare. Yeah. But then a big middle bit, which isn't very, very, very good. And it's just reflected in every part of society. So, I don't know whether you're thinking about the class system and all of that stuff. I find it so interesting after 40 years, 50 years, however long I've been living here. Yeah. Only recently understanding that people are more interested in the school you went to than the university you went to. And it's like, that's the biggest divide here. Mm-hmm. You know, of course you have the people who go to university and the people who never go and haven't been yet. But go on, the dark day, what happened? You didn't get a promotion. You didn't get a recommendation.
No, I don't think any of that. I think sometimes in institutions and, you know, and the NHS is not immune to this because it is a huge institution.
Yeah.
You know, you get institutional bias.
Yeah.
And that can be, if you're not tough-skinned, that can be very, very difficult to swallow. And bias occurs in many different ways, as you know.
Yeah.
Whether that's gender, whether that's race, whether that's just the way you do things, that, you know, you're not following a set guideline or a set pathway or a set style of behavior or a style of communication or whatever it is.
Okay, but what happened?
There's a bias there, which is difficult to get around. I think, you know, I think that in some ways I struggle to fit in certain scenarios, in certain situations. And when you don't fit in, then, you know, you start questioning whether this is the right job for you, whether this is the right place for you, whether this is the right training for you. And I think in some circumstances, you know, without getting too deep into it or giving away too much, because I think a lot of people are still working, I think that there are times when you have to just stand up for yourself. And those are the darkest days, because actually you're challenging behaviors that are unacceptable, or you're challenging people or personalities or biases that are unacceptable. And those were the darkest days where, as someone who is maybe come from Ireland or come from elsewhere, and if you're being treated differently to other people within the same environment, within the same context, and you know what that different treatment means, it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't mean you weren't given an audit project, or you weren't given the same type of patients, you weren't given the same type of training, or you weren't given access to education or access to consultants or whatever. Yeah,
it could come down to anything, can it? Tonality.
It could come down and reality is, Payman, that it comes down to everything. Yeah. Not to anything, it comes down to everything, doesn't it? Because bias affects everything. And so I think those were the dark days. And that really is, it's a test of character, actually, because
what's your reflection on that? Is your reflection on that? That's the way it was. And I just, you know, I lived it. And as a Pakistani guy in Saudi, for instance, I'm sure there was some bias there too, right? Yeah. Or is it that you got bitter about it? Cause, you know, it's interesting talking to you now. Yeah. I see you've got like very clear sort of right and wrong thing that you're putting out. or your feeling, I guess. Yeah. And, you know, almost like a very sort of binary sort of black and white about things and I don't think you are that, but in the way your delivery is, you know, your delivery is that, you know, because talking to you, you're very nuanced. And does that maybe rub people up the wrong way or something? I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think there's, I probably am speaking in a black and white way. I think, I'm also being, intentionally careful.
Incredibly sensitive boy as well.
Sorry.
Incredibly sensitive as well. I feel like you're quite sensitive.
I think I am. And I think I'm being very intentionally careful with my choice of words as well.
Sure.
I think my reflection on it is this. It's that sometimes you're in a situation in which you don't see a way out and you have to you have to accept where you are, whatever bias you're facing, whatever negative personality you're dealing with, you don't see a way out of it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think the nice part of where we live in the UK, the nice part of the society we're in is that there are ways out of it, you know, and actually dealing with those biases makes you who you are.
Mm.
And figuring out how to manage those personalities around you is what builds your character. And in a way, I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for it because where I am now is, you know, I have my own trainings, you know, whether the DCTs or whatever. And I'm so hypersensitive about how I speak to them, how I come across to them, how I deal with them, making sure I'm fair with everybody, whether they're male or female, or how I speak to my colleagues within the department or whatever, you know. I'm much more sensitive about that now than I was earlier on. So it's been an education for me to say, actually, I've been faced with things and it's been an example to me on how not to behave.
Absolutely.
So I think when you're in that situation, sometimes it's hard to see the wood from the trees. But on the other end of it, you know, it makes you a better person. It makes you a more sensitive person. And it probably means that you're better as a dentist. You're better as a father. You're better as a member of society. I'm sorry. I'm not being more specific.
No, I get it. I get it. What would you have done differently if I could rewind you 20 years, what was it, 15 years career wise? What would you have done differently or earlier or later or not at all?
I'm not sure, knowing what I know now, retrospect is such a beautiful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think I don't know if I would have. I may have gone into that private practice. I may have learned how to do the networking that I didn't know earlier on. And that would have changed my career path and my life path. So that's one thing. The second thing is I would probably say, and this is probably in part answering one of the later questions you might come to, but I'd probably ask for help sooner and faster.
Mm.
And part of that is being more self-aware and self-critical about what you're good at, what you're not good at, and where you need to develop. So I wasn't really self-aware earlier on in my career. And that was both in terms of my behavior, in terms of my development. So I would have been more self-aware and asked for help on those things a lot sooner. Those are two things I would say I would have done differently. Everything else, you know, I think I've made my mistakes. But I stand by them as well. I do stand by them. I don't think those are major things. But I think those two things are really important. You know, build those relationships early and look inside and figure out what you need to develop yourself.
So, look, you've got a five-month-old and a six-and-a-half year, is that right? 6.5 year old.
Yeah. Just over six.
Yeah. So do you get any time to do anything other than teeth and kids?
Well, we're doing this podcast.
Oh yeah. This is teeth. This is teeth.
Yeah.
To if you had, let's say I know this will sound really strange, but if you had half a day to yourself.
Oh man, it's impossible.
Let's say you had half a day to yourself. I don't know. Wife and kids were in another city. And you could do what you weren't working, do whatever you want. What would you do?
I'd probably tidy the garage. It's a mess. But you know.
Let's say the garage was clean as well. Like, let's have someone.
Yeah,
was,
no, joking, yeah. Of course. You know what? I'd probably go see some friends because all of my friends are pretty much all of them, all married. They've all got kids. And we as a group don't spend enough time together.
Mm.
And, you know, some of our wives are friends and stuff, and they actually have social. And we don't, you know, and part of that is actually just spending some time with your friends. It's not it's not actually therapy, but it kind of turns into it by, you know, by design or just by default. And it's fun to do that. So number one thing I do is I you know, I'd see my friends. And in February, my wife is going to be away while I'm here. And, you know, I'm already thinking about, okay, how many times can I see the boys in that 1 week? So I need to put the feelers out there. But, you know, if time allowed, you know, in the garage actually is a motorcycle.
Oh, okay.
And it's just gathering dust. It's gathering dust, and my brother and I have a twin brother.
Sports bike.
It's a Ducati Monster, so it's it's kind of like a more comfortable type of bike, but quick enough.
Uh-huh.
And I have a twin brother, Zahib. He's a specialist prosthodontist.
Oh.
And so he got me into the motorcycles because he was on them first. So what I'd love to do is, you know, half a day or ideally a week, and I would love to just ride over to Scotland and just go and see Scotland for a few days, or go and do Europe. Because that's something that I wanted to do for so long, is on a bike, do a bit of touring, and I never get the time to do it. So that would be my sort of my wish list.
Amazing. Does your brother work with Costas?
He does.
Oh, it's amazing. Amazing. That's your brother?
That's my twin brother, yes.
Amazing, man. Well, we had Costas on just two episodes ago. Episodes ago. Yeah.
Costas is such a nice guy. Zahib is all right. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, they do their injection molding course together.
Yeah. Oh, wow, I didn't realize. So, you look exactly the same.
Yeah, I mean, when I go to conferences, I'm constantly being stopped, and people sort of say, hey, how's it going? I sort of have to say, do I know you? And then I say, oh yeah, it's a twin thing. And then I have to get my phone out and show them the photographs. And then at that point, they're no longer offended that Zahib or my twin brother doesn't recognize them. So it happens all the time. I mean, it's happened in different cities. At one point, I don't remember which city I was in. Someone came up to me randomly in a European city and said, hey, Zahib.
No way.
I said, yeah, honestly, I can't remember where it was.
Did he study in Cork as well?
No, he studied in Dublin.
Oh, so that's when you split.
Yes, that's where we split. And I came to Manchester straight away. He came after a year. So he followed me over at that point.
How did it feel splitting? Were you like dying to sort of establish yourself as an individual?
No, I think it's a good thing. Because I definitely think it's a good thing. Because as twins, you know, you share a room. You share a womb, man. And then a room. And then you share friends in your life for the next 18 years.
Yeah.
You share the same teachers, you know, it's like a side by side experience. So I think it's good for everyone to have some of their own space, some of their own friends, and just to develop independently.
And what is he like you? Is he similar to you, or is he different to you?
I think in many ways he's similar, and in some ways he's different. Yeah, it's hard. And I think as the years have gone on, we've probably become a slightly more different, but we share a lot of the same personality traits. And yeah, I think you should do a podcast with him, and then you should tell me.
Yeah, I think I will. I had Costas, I didn't have him, but we kept talking about him. So listen, man, it's been an hour and a half. That went quick. Let's get to the final questions. Fantasy dinner party. Three guests. Dead or alive, who do you want to chat to?
I think that's such a difficult question, because I don't know. I sometimes feel like with these questions, it'll be a case of never meet your heroes. But you know, we can only go on the information that we kind of have about various people. And you know, to be honest, I could really only think of one person really that I would really care to. Oh, I would love, and I think it's unparalleled to listen to or to speak to or to learn from. And then, of course, you know, being a Muslim for me would be our Prophet Muhammad, and peace be upon him. I know, and his biography is obviously well written by various authors, you know, whether that was his organizational ability or his motivational abilities or his military abilities or whatever abilities you have. I think that's someone in history that is well documented and highly respected. So I think when I thought about, you know, the various characters throughout history, whether it's the Mother Teresa's or the Nelson Mandela's. I mean, Nelson was up there as well. I think for someone who has faced massive bias himself and for what he represented. But then, you know, I guess I am a Muslim. That is my primary identity, is not an orthodontist. It's not an Irish person or a Pakistani person. My primary identity is as a Muslim. And then I thought, well, you know, I am a Muslim, and who do I hold in the highest regard? And by no means am I the perfect Muslim. By no means. But that is the person I hold in highest regard. And so I know I was asked to pick three, but then I said, well, I can't really draw a parallel here. So that is the one that I picked.
Surely you want some loved ones with you on that day, you know? Why do you want to be one-on-one?
Well, I think the loved ones I have with me are the ones I have already. And really what I would want from a fancy dinner party, this is a hypothetical situation, is I would want to meet people who I've not met before and gain from them. You know, having the loved ones there is...
Well, no, grandfather's grandfather or whatever. You know what I mean? Like,
no, I do know what you mean, Pepe man. And in fact, my grandfather was up there because he was somebody that I never really, got to spend time with. Super intelligent man, a scientist, emeritus.
Your dad's dad?
My father's father, yeah.
Was he a doctor as well? No, scientist?
No, he was a geneticist. He was essentially an agricultural scientist who became a geneticist.
Wow.
And he developed this, he did the Pakistan most of his life. He did his PhD in the US in the 50s and 60s. And he developed this cotton seed, which didn't require pesticide, and put the pesticide companies out of business through the genetic modification. And he became a scientist emeritus. So, and I never got to spend much time with him. And I really respected him. And he was highly respected within the country. So my grandfather was up there just because I really loved and respected him. And my mother says I looked a lot like him. And he died before I really got to have that connection with him. And that was one of the downsides of moving around so much, is that we lost touch with our grandparents and with our extended families who were still there. So, you know, obviously the prophet's up there. But beyond that, I think, as I said, Nelson, for what he did, what he stood for so many years, and the lasting legacy of that, whether that's, you know, what his ancestors, sorry, what his successors are now talking about in Palestine or elsewhere. My grandfather's up there just because I'm someone that I just aspired to be like, and I never really got to spend some time with it. And I think, you know, I am this, like you said earlier, I seem to speak about ethics in black and white and the right and wrong in black and white.
Yeah.
And he was someone who was extremely intelligent, could have had a lavish life and set me up quite nicely, but he didn't. And it came down to him, you know, refusing the commercial aspects of his invention and giving that to the people. So he lived a very, you know, modest life for until his death. And that's something I find really inspirational, you know?
Absolutely, man. So look, you know, your grandfather was a geneticist, agricultural geneticist. Your dad was an anaesthetist. You guys both specialists, you and your brother. Is that expectation of doing something, you know, massively significant? Are you pushing that now to your kids as well? I know they're too young.
No. No, I think, you know, I don't think what I do is significant, is the truth of the matter.
It's quite significant, isn't it?
No, it's not. I mean, I do teeth. I do teeth. I do some cleft care, a little bit of it, you know, that's referred into me locally. Not much. That stuff is really important. But the rest of it, it's teeth. I don't think in the grand scheme
But I'm in kind of the pursuit of excellence, if you like. Yeah, I mean,
I think that the kids,
as far as I'm concerned, you could be the best shoemaker in Karachi, as long as you're the one who's trying to be the best, you know, whatever you do. What do you think? The reflections on kids. What would you encourage them to do?
I think I want the kids to be at the top of their game in whatever they want to do, but I'm not going to force them into dentistry or science or medicine or anything like that. But I do believe that they have to be at the top of whatever they do. I think every parent wants to believe their child is special and intelligent or whatever. And I think my children are intelligent and they're performing at an above average level. At least the 6-year-old is at the moment. thank God. So that's the Asian pressure coming again.
Yeah, yeah. Is it going to be stick or carrot?
Did I just say that out loud?
You did.
So whatever they want to do, it's cool. It's cool. But be a success. Make sure you can take care of your family and be the best at that. And that's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. What's not good enough for me is that you achieve less than what you are able to do.
Okay, yeah. But does it resonate with you that there were times where when your dad was being the best he could be, he wasn't around with you? And, you know, the sacrifice, you know, I've got Dipesh on my course, yeah? The guy wants to be the best in the world at teaching composite, right? There's massive sacrifice in that. Massive sacrifice. And often the sacrifice ends up being one of the family, right? Whether it's your wife or kids or, you know, because you don't let work go, or yourself, of course. That ends up being the biggest sacrifice sometimes. Do you recognize that? And are you going to adjust for that?
Yeah, I think that's a very, very, very valid point. And like you say, I don't think I'm the best orthodontist in the world or the best educator in the world. And I probably have found a balance in looking at family life and all those things. Yeah, I think we can always adjust our compass a little bit, accounting for those sorts of parameters and accounting for family life. And that probably is important because, you know, you can look at Steve Jobs and what he said on his deathbed, and you can look at all these people, and actually what do they talk about in those final moments is not really developing the iPhone or MacBook or being a trillionaire. It's probably the other things in their life. Which they have missed.
Mm. Apparently, he never said that stuff, but it's still relevant, man. It's still relevant.
Still poignant.
He should have said it. He should have said it, even if he didn't.
Then he should have.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's get to our final.
Yeah.
It's a deathbed question. It's difficult with someone so young to talk about deathbed, but let's just go there. On your deathbed, surrounded by your loved ones, hopefully your kids will be very old by that time, your friends and family and loved ones, three pieces of advice you'd leave to them or the world.
I had to really think about this as well. I mean, you forced me to go to deep places. Mm. And I think the three things that I would say, I think they're probably molded partly by your own experience, I think naturally. And I'm sure if you ask me this question in 20 years' time, I might give you a different answer. I don't know, but I might. I think the first thing I'd say is that ask for help sooner. Whatever that means to you, whether that's professionally, whether that's something you're struggling with, you're not feeling well mentally, whatever it is that you need help with, is to ask for that help as soon as possible. That's the first thing. And because, you know, if you can't do anything without that support, without that network around you, without feeling well, you can't. So the first thing is ask for that help. And then the second thing is to be probably more vigilant or pay more attention to the people around you and maybe your impact on them. So, you know, how are they feeling? What are they actually asking you for? You know, when your 6-year-old is crying or she's upset, or, you know, understand why that is. If she's really happy, really understand why that is. Don't just know that she's happy or upset. Figure out what it is that's driving that emotion. So be attentive to people. Mm. So you can help them, or you can support them, or you can just connect with them. And that'll just build your bonds. And then the last thing is, once you build that bond, is to remind each other of those bonds that you've built, you know, whether it's your friends, whether it's your brother, whomever it is, because I think a lot of the time we kind of just forget to remind each other of our relationships or the love you have for each other or whatever you've been through. You know, I've got friends who I've known for 20 years, or and I'm sure you have as well, for even longer. And you kind of just take them for granted after a while. Where it's good to sometimes sit down, and I don't think you have to get emotional every time or sentimental, but it's good to maybe look back and remind each other where you came from and what you were like and what those bonds actually mean to you. And I think if I did that earlier and sooner, I knew these things a bit faster in my life, maybe I'd have greater satisfaction, or, you know, before, or achieve that happiness sooner.
That's nice, man. Like a stay in touch with your buddies kind of one, right? And family and all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an interesting question, that one, yeah, because it's Prav's question. Prav's my co-host, right? And you can either answer that question with, I did this and you should too, or you could answer it in, I think you're more skewed this way, I didn't do this, but you should. which is the way I would answer this question as well. I'd be like, yeah, get right to the gym. Not because I
And that's the thing, right? I mean, it's, and that's what I was thinking, like, this is what I haven't done and it would be better. I mean, I don't know whether as humans we're self-deprecating.
You are, buddy. It's nice. It's a nice thing. Because again, much better this way than the other way. But, you know, dude, a lot of times I feel like, you're punishing yourself sometimes, not you, one punishes oneself sometimes a bit too much. I mean, life's too short to punish yourself too much, man. You know, that just amount of, I'm looking back on it. Yeah. Looking back and thinking the things that you were thinking 15 years ago and then you realize, God, all of that was rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, and not just that. I mean, sometimes you look back and you cringe on some of the stuff you've done or thought about. Too. You know, and I really sort of tried to shake some memories and thought, what were you doing? Or what did you do that for? What were you thinking? And I sort of just had to almost shake the cringe off my back.
Shake the cringe off my back. Nice way to end it, my buddy. Lovely conversation. I really, really enjoyed that, man. Really did.
No, that was amazing, hey, man. I think there's so much scope for more of this. And to be honest, I enjoyed this way more than I thought I would. So thank you for having me on.
You're a natural talker, buddy. You are a natural teacher.
Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for taking your time, man.
Cheers, man.
This is Dental Leaders, the podcast where you get to go one-on-one with emerging leaders in dentistry. Your hosts, Payman Langrudi and Prav Solanki.
Thanks for listening, guys. If you got this far, you must have listened to the whole thing. And just a huge thank you, both from me and Pay, for actually sticking through and listening to what we had to say and what our guest has had to say, because I'm assuming you got some value out of it.
If you did get some value out of it, think about subscribing. And if you would, share this with a friend who you think might get some value out of it too. Thank you so, so, so much for listening. Thanks.
And don't forget our 6-star rating.